Tonight, though, the subject is the Dark Night experience and its implications for Christian life, for contemporary life. So not just about the two Teresas that are identified on your handout, but about the implications of what they went through for us today. Still, the two Teresas that are identified on your handout have the starring role. So first on stage is going to be Mother Teresa, now Saint Teresa of Calcutta, or Calcutta, if you want the older version of the name of the city, founder of the Missionaries of Charity. And next up will be her namesake, Saint Therese of Lisieux, or more fully, Saint Therese of the Child Jesus and the Holy Face, the discalced Carmelite who died at the age of 24 in 1897. So I'm going to be focusing on the extraordinary connections between these two saints and the dark night experience that they both endured. I'm going to talk a little bit about historic interpretations of this experience as well as more recent ones, and then at the end conclude with some thoughts about the dark night through which we as a society seem to be passing at the present moment. So it's kind of a conversation across centuries about faith and doubt, about perseverance and holiness. So I'll start with Mother Teresa. I actually saw her once in the flesh, only once, and that was at Harvard, actually. She'd been invited by the graduating seniors in 1982 to give what's called the Class Day Address on the eve of commencement. And I remember how tiny she looked on this grand stage with all of the beautiful sort of plumage that everybody was wearing. She was in her sari. And actually, the next day, John Kenneth Galbraith, the economist, escorted her to receive her honorary degree. And he's huge, right? So you get this impression of this tiny little force of nature. Because when she stood up there and made her Class Day speech, she really made a rather formidable demand on her hearers. This is the graduating seniors at Harvard College. And she said to them, "Now I want you to go out into the world and use your gifts to serve the poor, not to get ahead." And then she said, "But the poor are everywhere. They come in many different forms. There's the unwelcome refugee, the child at risk in the womb, the difficult relative that nobody wants to visit. The affluent, in fact, can be poor if they have every treasure except the one treasure that makes life worth living." So that was her speech, and it was well received. But we would have to say that she demanded a lot more of herself than she did of the students. As the daughter of devout Catholic parents of Albanian descent, growing up among Catholics, Muslims, and Orthodox Christians in Skopje, which was then a city in Yugoslavia and is now the capital of the Republic of Macedonia, she felt called from her early childhood to follow Jesus and to be his instrument in the world. You may have heard the expression, God's pencil. She wanted to be God's pencil. As soon as she came of age, that is 18, in 1928, she joined the Sisters of Loretto at their Irish branch in Dublin and took the name Teresa of the Child Jesus after Saint Therese of Lisieux, who took her name after the big Teresa, Teresa of Avila. This order, informally called the Loretto Sisters, had been founded by a 17th century English recusant woman named Mary Ward, who set out to create on her own, kind of like Mother Teresa, set out on her own to create a non-cloistered religious community modeled on the spirituality of the Society of Jesus, so with both active and contemplative dimensions. This soon became a worldwide order, and the Irish Loretto Sisters, whom Mother Teresa joined, had a presence in India that went back to the mid-19th century. So the newly minted Sister Teresa was sent to the Bengal missions, which is just what she wanted. She had a strong missionary impulse. So she completed her novitiate in the Loretto house in Darjeeling and then was employed as a teacher at St. Mary's, the Loretto school in Calcutta, where the girls found her inspiring. They loved her. She loved them. She learned their languages. She prayed for their conversion. And she proved to be a natural leader, so she was appointed to the post of principal in 1944, which gave her considerable public prominence. Everything was going swimmingly in her career. But her inner life was taking another route. And though her fellow nuns knew nothing about it, in 1942 she had taken a very dramatic step. She had made a private vow, which she told her confessors about, but no one else, to give Jesus whatever he might ask, not to refuse him anything, in her words, under pain of mortal sin. And the whole rest of her story follows from this vow. The next milestone was 4 years later, on September 10th, 1946, which is the day celebrated by the Missionaries of Charity as Inspiration Day. Mother Teresa was on a train traveling from Calcutta to Darjeeling when she heard the voice of Jesus addressing her. Not just an inner prompting, she heard the voice. And on the train, and then over the next several months, Jesus spoke to her repeatedly, calling her to leave her happy life as a Loretto nun and follow him into the streets of Calcutta. And as she related his words to her spiritual directors, he said, "I want missionaries of charity who would be my fire of love amongst the poor, the sick, the dying, and the little children. Wilt thou refuse?" She couldn't refuse, right? She had made a vow in 1942 not to refuse him anything. I don't think she would have refused anyway. I wonder if Jesus is talking to you. It'd be hard to refuse. So she wrote a letter to the Mother General of her order and said, "I know you will be anxious about me, but please do not keep me back from the path where he wants me to go. If you were in India, if you saw what I've seen for so many years, your heart too would long to make our Lord better known to the poor who suffer most terrible sufferings, and then also eternity in darkness because there are no nuns to give them a helping hand." So that makes it pretty clear that it wasn't social work alone that called Mother Teresa to the streets. Her aim was to rescue the poor not only from their material destitution, but also from what she considered the ultimate destitution of eternal separation from God. Now in later years, and this may be because she was in conversation with a group of very brilliant Jesuits who were active in interfaith dialogue, in later years she would say that her intention was not to win converts, but to help Hindus be better Hindus, Muslims better Muslims, Sikhs better Sikhs, Parsis better Parsis. It's a very multi-religious neighborhood. But even so, her mission would always be a wholly Christocentric one, in which care for the poor and zeal for souls and radical identification with Christ and his passion were all intertwined. It was all aspects of the same thing. In fact, she saw care for the poor virtually as a sacrament, following the words of Jesus in Matthew 25, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." It was a kind of charter for everything she was doing. That told her, as she put it, that Christ was truly present, almost like a Eucharistic presence. Christ was truly present in the distressing disguise of the poorest of the poor. And so Mother Teresa refused him nothing. She never counted the cost. She exhausted herself in his service. And what was her reward for this unstinting devotion? 50 years of interior darkness and desolation, beginning soon after her founding of the Missionaries of Charity and lasting until her death in 1997. So what do we make of that? God seemed absent, heaven empty, prayer meaningless, her labors rejected. Again, her sisters knew nothing of this ordeal that she was going through. All they saw was the radiance of her smile and her indefatigable energy. But her spiritual directors did know, and they urged her to write down what she was going through. In fact, they often asked her to write a letter to Jesus about your feeling that it doesn't exist. It's a wonderful paradox there. So there's an example of such a letter on your handout, the first passage on your handout, which begins, "In my soul, I feel just that terrible pain of loss, of God not wanting me, of God not being God, of God not really existing." And then in parentheses, she says, "Jesus, please forgive my blasphemies. I've been told to write everything. And this goes on and on with her character. They didn't correct her spelling and punctuation. She uses dashes for the punctuation all the time, but it gives you that sense of a kind of inexorable experience that moment to moment is unfolding. I no longer pray. My soul is not one with you. The work holds no joy, no attraction, no zeal. But again, she also says, I do not doubt that it was you who called me. It was you, I know. That is why the work is yours. But I have no faith. I don't believe. Well, we weren't supposed to know about all this, actually. Mother Teresa begged her Jesuit confidants to destroy the papers in which she disclosed her secrets. But they disregarded her wish after her death, because they believed that the record of her struggles and the example of her perseverance would be a gift to the church. It was a gamble, I suppose, but it's proven to be right, and I certainly hope Mother Teresa has forgiven them. She died in 1997, and 3 years later, John Paul II authorized the beginning of her cause for beatification and canonization, with the Canadian Missionary of Charity, Father Brian Kolodichik, as her postulator. She was beatified on Mission Sunday, appropriately, October 19th, 2003, in Rome. And a month later, her postulator, Father Kolodichik, ran a four-part series in the Zenit News Agency online called The Soul of Mother Teresa, Hidden Aspects of Her Interior Life, in which he let the world in on her secret. For some reason, and I saw these, and I was so struck by it when that happened, but then for some reason the articles were taken down from the internet almost immediately, like the next day it seemed like, after they appeared. But in the summer of 2007, Father Kolodichik published Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light, which has extensive quotations from her letters and private writings, disclosing this, both the secrets about her conversation with Jesus on the train and after that, and the long dark night. And this provoked some rather intense questioning, as you can imagine. Did Mother Teresa really lose her faith? Critics, like Christopher Hitchens, author of The Missionary Position, imagined that these new revelations would complete the work he had begun and others had begun of trying to discredit her. Fortunately, most coverage took its cue from the careful commentaries provided by Father Kolodichik. Time magazine ran a nuanced article as its cover story, and there were other reasonable assessments that treated her trial of faith as indeed a deep puzzle, but not a scandal. To those familiar with the history of Christian mysticism, some intriguing precedents suggested themselves. The most obvious interpretation, and the first to occur to Mother Teresa, was that her interior darkness was the result of some deep personal faults of her own that needed to be corrected in the crucible of suffering. But she was fortunate in her spiritual directors. They would not play the part of Job's comforters, but would help her to understand her experience as a transformation wrought by grace rather than a punitive measure. And there was a lot of help to be found in the mystical theology of the 16th century Spanish Carmelite, St. John of the Cross. St. John says that a time may come, as one advances along the path to union with God, when the spiritual practices in which one used to delight lose their savor, and all consolation in the love of God seems lost in an impenetrable dark night. Yet it is just under the cover of this darkness, St. John taught, that God is most powerfully present, cleansing the soul of her passions and preparing her for the most inconceivable blessedness of divine union. So as John of the Cross described it, the dark night is a purifying ordeal during which the soul is united to God at some level that I guess you could see it as sort of below the radar of the senses, or perhaps above the apex, the highest intellectual faculties of the soul. In other words, on a level that just simply doesn't register in our ordinary waking conscious experience. Mother Teresa knew the Carmelite mystical tradition, and she knew of great saints, of other religious heroes who had experienced the dark night in different forms, many of them founders for some reason. St. Jane Frances de Chantal, the 17th century French foundress of the Visitandines, St. Paul of the Cross, the 18th century Italian founder of the Passionists, and there were others. She knew about this, but it didn't exactly console her simply to be aware of these precedents. But in 1961, she had a breakthrough in her understanding with the help of the fourth and last in the series of her remarkable Jesuit confidants, that is, of Father Joseph Neuner. Father Neuner wrote down what he thought was going on here. He said there was no indication of any serious failure on her part which could explain the spiritual dryness. It was simply the dark night of which all masters of spiritual life know, though I never found it so deeply and for so many years as in her. There's no human remedy against it. It can be born only in the assurance of God's hidden presence and of the union with Jesus, who in his passion had to bear the burden and darkness of the sinful world for our salvation. The sure sign of God's hidden presence, I'm still quoting from Father Neuner, the sure sign of God's hidden presence in this darkness is the thirst for God, the craving for at least a ray of his light. No one can long for God unless God is present in his or her heart. Thus, the only response to this trial is the total surrender to God and the acceptance of the darkness in union with Jesus. So Father Neuner encouraged Mother Teresa to interpret her trial as certainly not punitive, maybe even not purifying. Basically, he wanted her to see it as union with Christ in his passion and as reparation for the unbelief of our age. This insight didn't remove the pain and the longing that she felt, but it did enable Mother Teresa to say, I have come to love the darkness. You know, if the Carmelites are right, this dark night experience is a trial that God reserves for his greatest friends. St. Teresa famously remarked, no wonder you have so few of them. And among those greatest friends, the closest to Mother Teresa, spiritually speaking anyway, was her namesake, whom I've mentioned already, St. Thérèse of Lisieux, the young French Carmelite saint who died at the age of 24 in 1897, author of the best-selling Story of a Soul, and famous for embodying what's called the little way of spiritual childhood. Like Mother Teresa, Thérèse made a private vow to refuse nothing to Jesus. In Thérèse's case, there was actually a series of vows culminating in a great act of oblation to merciful love just 2 years before her death. Like Mother Teresa, and despite being deeply attached to her family, Thérèse longed to be a missionary. She was an ardent spirit who at age 14 would bring her suit for early admittance to religious life directly to Pope Leo XIII himself, who had other things on his agenda, I guess. In fact, she was disobeying admonitions to be silent during the papal audience. She longed to be all things for Christ. She said, I feel the vocation of the warrior, the priest, the apostle, the doctor, the martyr. I feel within my soul the courage of the crusader, and I would want to die on the field of battle in defense of the church. But if she could not play every part in the drama of Christendom, she knew that there was one vocation in which all others were fused. And she said, I understood that love comprised all vocations, that love was everything, that it embraced all times and places. Then in the excess of my delirious joy, I cried out, O Jesus, my love, my vocation is love. Yes, I have found my place in the church, in the heart of the church, my mother. I shall be love, and thus I shall be everything, and thus my dream will be realized. It was, of course, her fragile health that made it impossible for her to enter a foreign Carmel. She had hoped to go to Hanoi, for example. But she served in the missions vicariously by taking on missionary priests as pen pals and prayer companions. And above all, she realized that she could realize her vocation without going out of the everyday round of obligations and routines, simply by doing ordinary things with extraordinary love. And here we have the inspiration for Mother Teresa's saying, which is a favorite and often misquoted internet meme, "Don't look for big things, just do small things with great love." One of Mother Teresa's last acts, actually on the morning of the day she died, was to dictate a letter to her nuns about St. Therese. It was just on the verge of World Mission Sunday when Pope John Paul II, in 1997, was about to make St. Therese Doctor of the Church, the 33rd Doctor of the Church. And Mother Teresa wrote to her nuns saying, "Can you imagine? For doing little things with great love, the Church is making her a doctor, like St. Augustine and the big St. Teresa." And so as a kind of last testament, Mother Teresa urged her community to follow the little way of St. Therese. So that makes it all the more remarkable that St. Therese suffered during the last months of her short life a trial of faith comparable, not in length, but definitely in intensity to Mother Teresa's. And the story of that dark night begins on the vigil of Good Friday in 1896, when she felt a warm gush of blood coming from her lungs, which was a sign of what would be incurable tuberculosis. And she felt joy because she said, "I was interiorly persuaded that Jesus, on Good Friday, on the anniversary of his own death, was calling me." It was like a sweet and distant murmur that announced the bridegroom's arrival, she said. But this sweet and distant murmur would also mark the beginning of her trial of faith. And this is how Therese describes it in a letter written in June 1897 to her prioress. "During those very joyful days of the Easter season, Jesus made me feel that there were really souls who have no faith, and who through the abuse of grace lost this precious treasure, the source of the only and real and pure joys. He permitted my soul to be invaded by the thickest darkness so that the thought of heaven, up until then so sweet to me, would be no longer anything but the cause of struggle and torment." This is the second quote on your handout, actually. This trial was to last not a few days or a few weeks. It was not to be extinguished until the hour set by God himself, and this hour has not yet come. I would like to be able to express what I feel, but alas, I believe this is impossible. One would have to travel through this dark tunnel to understand its darkness. And she speaks of descending into a thick fog and also of being mocked by the darkness that enveloped her. "Everything has disappeared," she says. "It seems to me that the darkness, borrowing the voice of sinners, says mockingly to me, 'You are dreaming about the light, about a fatherland embalmed in the sweetest perfumes. You are dreaming about the eternal possession of the creator of all these marvels. You believe that one day you will walk out of this fog that surrounds you. Advance, advance. Rejoice in death, which will give you not what you hope for, but a night still more profound, the night of nothingness." So, St. Therese's trial of faith would continue. It would last for 18 months from that Easter until moments before her death on September 30th, 1897. So, what do we make of this? Certainly, I'd say in both Teresa's, the case could be made for natural burnout, at least as a factor. But I don't think a simple diagnosis of depression fits the case, though. You know, throughout her 50 years of darkness, Mother Teresa was a bundle of executive energy, always smiling, always on the go, unstinting in prayer as well as service, and quite a demanding superior to her nuns. This does not look like a classic case of depression. Therese, too, remained a force to be reckoned with. Even in her illness, she was passionate, insistent, humorous, until her death. It may take some generations before the dark night of the two Teresas is fully understood. Perhaps we'll begin to think of it as something akin to the stigmata that some saints receive in participating in the Passion of Christ. But whatever they were up to, it's tempting to think that they were in it together. It almost seems as if the contemplative missionary Mother Teresa and the missionary contemplative Saint Therese collaborated on their mission statements, which is the third section of your handout. I think it's on the second page. Saint Therese said, "I feel that my mission is about to begin, my mission of making others love God as I love him, my mission of teaching my little way to souls. If God answers my requests, my heaven will be spent on earth up until the end of the world. Yes, I want to spend my heaven in doing good on earth." And Mother Teresa says, "If I ever become a saint, I will surely be one of darkness. I will continually be absent from heaven to light the light of those in darkness on earth." Mother Teresa died in the same month as Saint Therese, 100 years later, was beatified on World Mission Sunday, exactly 6 years from the day that Saint Therese was made Doctor of the Church. She experienced the same missionary contemplative or contemplative missionary call. She made the same private vow of self-surrender, suffered the same desolation of faith, embodied in the face of that desolation the same teaching of fidelity in small things, and made the same promise to spend her heaven doing good on earth. So I've already suggested the dark night of the twin Teresas may fruitfully be interpreted in light of St. John of the Cross and the traditional threefold progression of purgation, illumination, and union, which is the pathway to deification, to share the divine life, which in modern times was brilliantly expounded and systematized by the French Dominican Father Reginald Gargu-Lagrange in his massive, massive classic from 1938, The Three Ages of the Interior Life. Can't get into all the details of that. And we can't read their souls, but I think on the safe assumption that the two Teresas were far advanced in their journey to union with God, the dark night they experienced would have to be classed, according to this progression, as an instance of passive purification of the spirit, which can accompany the highest forms of infused contemplation. So, but I'm going to set that aside and just say that at the same time, both Teresas seem to resist systematization. I think in part because of the really pronounced intensity of their dark night experience, which defies categories, it seems, and in part because they were also deeply imbued with the characteristic teachings of the 17th century French school of spirituality, which was an important counter-reformation movement of spiritual renewal, inspired by the deep, self-forgetful, Christ-centered interiority and missionary zeal of St. Francis de Sales and St. Vincent de Paul. This is a loosely defined school, the French school, and I'm not an expert on it, but I know there's a connection here to be explored further. It would include such figures as the French oratorian Cardinal Pierre de Bérulle, who brought the Discalced Carmelites to France, Jean-Jacques Ollier, founder of the Sulpicians, John Hughes, teacher of the devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus and Mary, and others. These French saints and mystics may not all be singing exactly the same notes, but they do have some things in common which really seem to provide a framework for understanding more about our twin Teresas. They have a powerful sense of human littleness, swept up in the majesty and sacrificial love of Christ, a devotion to all things Marian, like Mary, and a disposition of sacrificial surrender to the will of the Father in all things. According to this school, or to many of its proponents, to thirst for personal contact with Jesus, to thirst, whether or not the thirst is quenched, was to share in the thirst of Jesus. Jesus says, "I thirst." To experience desolation was to be united to Christ's moments of desolation into his passion. to accept one's trials and renounce one's own will is to participate in the obedience of Christ to the Father. Indeed, whatever the present moment brings, whether consolation or affliction, is to be embraced with an unreserved fiat, like Mary's fiat, like Christ's, be it done to me according to thy word. For it is in the present moment, in ordinary life, that we encounter the will of God. Such is the teaching we find in the 18th century French spiritual classic. Some of you may have run across Abandonment to Divine Providence. You may think of it as a work by the Jesuit Father Jean-Pierre de Caussade. Recently, his authorship has been questioned. Actually, the French critical edition of this text says it's not by Caussade. So I'll just call it Abandonment. This text is also well known to English readers under the title The Sacrament of the Present Moment. When the twin Teresa say to us, I have come to love the darkness, they are echoing a spirituality of abandonment, devotion to providence. Whatever happens is the will of God. A willingness to be utterly consumed in the fire of divine love from moment to moment. But I suggest that although the twin Teresas are rooted in this multi-layered spiritual tradition, in the Carmelite doctors, and the French school, and the treatise on abandonment, and though they revel in the archaic-sounding language of victim souls and reparation, they speak to us as quintessentially modern saints through their solidarity with non-believers. Both Teresas made the unusual promise to be absent from heaven and remain present with us. I teach world religions, and this always reminds me of the Bodhisattva ideal in Mahayana Buddhism, where it's an implication of enlightenment, not to want to escape from this world of sorrows, but to be, but to remain within it, even when one no longer, strictly speaking, has to do so. So they've made this promise to stay with us. And I think it is in keeping with that promise that they have something especially relevant to say about the particular kinds of darkness that we confront now in our own time. I think you might agree that we are, as a society, going through a dark night in which faith often seems eclipsed. We look around, at least where I come from, New England, godless New England, we look around and we see empty pews and shuttered churches, or we hear fresh news of abuse by powerful clerics, or perhaps we feel ill-equipped to defend the intellectual respectability of our faith when kind of popular versions of science seem to have all the prestige. Or perhaps we imagine we've lost our faith because popular psychology has convinced us that faith depends upon having a lot of personally fulfilling religious experiences. Or we realize we are rank beginners, not advanced contemplatives undergoing purification on the path to union. So perhaps ours may not be a dark night so much as a twilight of the soul. But however it may be, it's encouraging to hear of the fidelity of truly heroic saints who faced desolation and doubt and who radiated what I think of as objective Christian joy, even when subjectively their own hearts were dim. Objective Christian joy. There are a couple of modern authors who I think are really good on this theme. One is the Benedictine abbot and scholar Dom John Chapman, whose spiritual letters I recommend. These were letters that he wrote to many lay people who were seeking his advice during the early decades of the 20th century, and in which he distilled the lessons of the Carmelites and the French school and the treatise on abandonment, suggesting that what matters in prayer is the simple act, even if you feel dry and empty, the intention to pray. Prayer is one long act of love, he said, not of my love to God, but of his to me. And it will be going all right if it feels all wrong. Someone who wrote to him on the threshold of the First World War about lack of peace, he says to him, I expect the interior peace you would like to have is not attainable under the circumstances. But there is another interior peace which consists in simply willing what God wills. But especially pertinent, I think, for our purposes, is an example from 1923 when someone wrote to him about loss of faith. And he says, you know, in the 17th and 18th centuries, most pious souls seem to have gone through a period in which they felt sure that God had reprobated them. This doesn't seem to happen nowadays, but the corresponding trial of our contemporaries seems to be the feeling of not having any faith. Not temptations against any particular article, usually, but a mere feeling that religion is not true. The only remedy is just to despise the whole thing and pay no attention to it, except, of course, to assure our Lord that one is ready to suffer from it for as long as he wishes, which seems an absurd paradox to say to a person one doesn't believe in. But then, that is the trial. Faith is really particularly strong all the time. Flannery O'Connor gave us very similar advice to the poet Alfred Korn, who at the time was a young college freshman struggling with loss of faith. And she said, I think that this experience you are having of losing your faith, or as you think, of having lost it, is an experience that in the long run belongs to faith. I don't know how the kind of faith required of a Christian living in the 20th century can be at all if it is not grounded on this experience that you are having right now of unbelief. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. It is the most natural and most human and most agonizing prayer in the Gospels. And I think it is the foundation prayer of faith. Lord, I believe. Help thou my unbelief. Today, it may be that we don't feel God's presence because we're distracted and ensnared by the media, or because of illness or exhaustion, natural burnout, too busy caring for our family, perhaps trying to make ends meet, or because of intellectual difficulties or because of scandal. God's face is hidden from us. But is that so strange? It's actually an ancient doctrine emphasized by many theologians and mystics that God dwells in inaccessible light, a light so absolute that it cancels out the images we may form of him. On the other hand, just imagine what would happen if God simply showed up unmistakably as like a 10-foot-tall superhero. Or the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard talks about, imagine God just showed up as a rare, enormously large green bird with a red beak. We would be squished if God just showed up like that, with no doubt that it was God. Our free will and our agency would be annihilated. Our response would be servile adoration. And that's not the way God wants to be known and worshipped. The Catholic view, rather, is that God tempers his presence to our condition with a certain measure of hiddenness. He makes himself known in the two books of Scripture and nature, and supremely as the incarnate Word. He is present in the Eucharist and in the face of every person we meet, but always in a hidden manner, never in a way that would compel our recognition and assent. Mother Teresa saw a connection between these two kinds of hidden presence, Christ hidden in the poorest of the poor and Christ hidden in the Eucharist. And she gave Eucharistic adoration a central place in the daily apostolic service of the missionaries of charity. Again, a contemplative and heart of an active way of life. Since we're at the Thomistic Institute tonight, I'll just remind you of what Thomas Aquinas says about the Eucharist in his Eucharistic hymn, Corpus Christi hymn, or in the section of the Pange Lingua, the Tantum Ergo Sacramentum. Faith must supply what is lacking to our feeble senses. Christ's presence is imperceptible, but faith supplies the lack. And so for Mother Teresa, faith supplied the lack, what was lacking to even her finely tuned spiritual senses. And her radiant smile remained undiminished through the long dark night. And the same for Saint Therese. But it wasn't a kind of stoic determination that kept them going in the face of this pain and desolation. They were anchored in that hidden presence of Christ. They possessed in their longing for God a strong measure of that objective Christian joy. And that objective Christian joy
I believe, is our birthright as Christians, even, or maybe especially, if we're going through a dark night. That's it. Thank you.
Very nice.